Yeah.
How capable is one learning?
It depends a lot on the person. And I think that's a good point. You know, how capable are we of developing wisdom if we need other qualities first? Well, in order to realize emptiness, we do need, to do a lot of purification and a lot of collection of positive potential through all the other practices. They're really essential to do. And so it's important to do all those other practices, but it's also important to have some understanding of emptiness. Because remember, when we were talking about all those other practices, we're also supposed to practice the wisdom of generosity and the wisdom of ethics and the wisdom of patience. And so it's really important also to develop some understanding of the teachings of wisdom, because those help us practice the foregoing practices in a much deeper way. Yeah? So for example, if you don't know anything about the teachings on wisdom, then let's say you do a visualization of the Buddha and the light coming. Then you're going to see, you know, the Buddha is inherently existent. All your garbage is inherently existent. The purification is inherently existent. The light coming is inherently existent. And so you're seeing everything in the same, you know, kind of boxed in categorical way. Whereas if we have some teachings on emptiness, then when we do the visualization, let's say, of the Buddha and the light coming, we might begin to say, oh, well, this Buddha isn't inherently existent. And, oh, gee, all my garbage isn't inherently existent either. Imagine that. Yeah? You know? And once you start realizing that your garbage isn't inherently existent, then your guilt starts to go away, because guilt really, you know, gravitates towards inherent existence, towards that wrong view. Okay? So the understanding of emptiness can really enhance all the other practices, as well as the other practices enhancing emptiness. And in the same way, you know, when we get even some understanding of emptiness, it can help the bodhicitta increase, because as we understand emptiness, then we begin to see how, you know, all of samsara, there's actually a way to end it. Know, that it's actually possible to remove the ignorance, and that all the suffering other beings are undergoing, they don't really have to undergo. And so that makes your compassion and your altruism much stronger. Okay? So I think, you know, it's important to get them both together and to put them hand in hand. And also, because we shouldn't think that, you know, you do all these other practices without knowing anything about wisdom, and then all of a sudden, you know, you start studying wisdom from scratch. Because I think it's really important. Remember this whole way of studying Dharma, we talk a lot about planting seeds. And I remember when I first started getting the wisdom teachings, it was like, what are you talking about, Geshe-la? What was that word? How do you spell it? You know? And then kind of the second time I heard it, it was like, oh, yeah, I remember those weird-sounding words. And then the third time, oh, yeah, I remember what they mean. And the fourth, oh, yeah, you know. And so it's like a thing of really kind of learning in a gradual way, training the mind in a gradual way so that you can understand. The tricky thing about the word vipassana, and this is something that I think it's good. There's a number of words that are used here in the West that are not the traditional way of using those words. For example, the word vipassana. Vipassana is meditation to develop, it means special insight. So there's, you know, particularly special insight, realizing emptiness. So it's a particular type of meditation. What's happened here in the West is they've taken the name of one type of meditation and made it sound like a whole tradition. You see, because usually there's the Theravada tradition, Zen tradition, Tibetan tradition, Pure Land tradition, things like that. And now all of a sudden in the West we have the Vipassana tradition. But actually, the people who say, I practice Vipassana, they learned it from Theravada masters. But when the Westerners took the teachings here in the West, they didn't take all of the teachings of the Theravada masters, like refuge and karma, you know, all this other stuff. They basically extracted this one kind of meditation because they thought it was really effective for Westerners. And said insight, Vipassana, and made it like a tradition. But actually, Vipassana meditation is found in all the Buddhist traditions. The type of meditation. Yeah? And actually, in what they now call the Vipassana tradition, it's not really the Vipassana tradition, it's the Theravada tradition, and in there you have not only Vipassana meditation, you have refuge, you have karma, you have metta, you have all sorts of other things too. Yeah. No. So there's a whole bunch of words here in the West that are not used in traditional way, like the word yogi, you know. When I came back to the West, and anybody who goes to a retreat is called a yogi. You know, in Asia, that's not how you use the word yogi. You know, in Asia, the yogis, they're the ones who go up to the mountains and are the really serious practitioners. You know, the yogi doesn't mean just somebody who goes for a weekend retreat. And similarly, the word sangha, in Asia, sangha, you know, when you talk about the three refuges, sangha are the beings who have realized emptiness, or in a general way, sangha refers to the monastic community. And it's only here in the West that anybody who comes to a Buddhist course is automatically called sangha. You know, I mean, it was interesting in Tucson when His Holiness, somebody asked a question about sangha, and did people notice he started talking about the monastics? Because that's what the word means, because that's what it means in an Asian context. Yeah. So you find all these different words that are, you know, used differently here than the traditional way. Yeah. I mean, I always use the old ways because that's how I grew up. Yeah. My Buddhist babyhood was in Asia.